So we're going to carry on exploring who the Buddha is using this particular text, which is a traditional text chanted all over the Buddhist world, called the Tiratnavandana. So some of you who may not have been here before may not have a copy of the text, or you may have just forgotten it. I've got more copies here. If you put your hand up, then people on the team will hand them out. So yes, this is a text that is chanted all over the Buddhist world as a it's a devotional text, as a salutation it's called, but it's a devotional text oriented towards the three jewels. There's one here, James. So we're saluting the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The three jewels. Tiratna meaning three jewels, Vandana meaning the salutation, and I was emphasising that it's not just a casual nod in the direction of the Buddha, but a profound reverence that would be normally, traditionally embodied by a prostration. You would actually touch your head to the ground in front of the feet of the Buddha. And that would be an appropriate form of greeting, indicating your reverence, as it were. So it's that sort of mood that is, that mood of devotion that is conjured up by these words. And here you've got the words in Pali, which is how they're chanted all over the Buddhist world, and a translation by Sangharakshita, on the right, and we're going through word by word, unpacking the meaning of the words, so that we can get a better idea as to what a traditional concept of the Buddha is, who the Buddha is, so that as Buddhists, who we're going for refuge to. When we say, I'm a Buddhist, if you say, I'm a Buddhist, what you're actually saying is that I go for refuge to the Buddha as these words depict him. So particularly we're looking at the second verse, or that's where we are, the verse beginning Ittipiso. And that verse occurs again and again in the Pali Canon, describing the Buddha. So that's the verse that occurs throughout the Pali Canon. The verses surrounding that are verses of devotion. So this verse, the second verse, is describing the qualities of the Buddha. And you could say it's a sort of definition of the Buddha. And what I've been emphasising is that the Buddha himself said that if you were able to recite these words with full, unwavering faith and conviction in the reality behind those words, then you would be a stream entrant. So he's sort of defining a stream entrant as somebody who would have unwavering faith in the reality behind these words, in the three jewels, because they would have seen the truth of the refuges for themselves in their own experience directly, not just received in received kind of opinion, but directly experienced the truth of who the Buddha is. Yeah. So this side of stream entry, if we're not stream entrants, what we're trying to do in reciting these words is build up some sort of conviction. That might be a provisional conviction, a provisional faith in who the Buddha is. Even if it's not, if faith is too sort of problematic a word for you, you could just say we're trying to build up an understanding of who the Buddha is. Yeah, because who the Buddha is from within the Buddhist tradition, and in a way that's the only way you can really see him, is not, he's not just a very wise, kind man. He's the pinnacle of what human existence can become. He's what is the supreme being, not just in human existence, but he's the supreme being in terms of the pinnacle of any being. This is what a being can become, and there is no being higher. So that was what we were looking at last week when we looked at the word anuttaro. So anuttaro is, if you're looking at the second verse beginning itapiso, then it's the third line down where you've got lokavidu and then anuttaro. And anuttaro means, well, here it's translated as unsurpassed, but it's that which has no higher. So it's probably connected with the word in English, utter, in terms of, you know, utterly supreme, as it were. An un is a negative prefix. So it's without anything higher, the highest a being can be. So we looked at that last week, so I'm not going to say any more. If you do want to, if you're interested in catching up and you haven't heard these talks, then they're available on the LBC website, or I've been pointing people at Subhuti's original talks that I'm basing this on, which are available on Free Buddhist Audio. Yeah. So the next phrase here is Purisadama Sarati. Purisadama Sarati. And in this translation on the right, anuttaro is concatenated with Purisadama Sarati. But we've just looked at as anuttaro as in its own right. I'll say a little bit more about what it means when we've looked at Purisadama Sarati to elide it, what it means to elide it. Purisa is an Indian word for, well, literally, it means man. But it means more definitively, it means human being. So it's man as in mankind or humankind. So Purisa is here, it means human, the human being. And Dhamma here is a word meaning capable or requiring training. So somebody has to be capable of being trained. Sometimes it's even translated as one who desires training. So it means what it means is that the Buddha can teach us if we are desiring training. Yeah, if we're receptive. The Buddha cannot teach people who don't want to learn. If they're not receptive, then in a way there's nothing that the Buddha can say. There's nothing that the Dharma can say. There's nothing that Buddhism can say if somebody isn't receptive. There's a famous story, isn't there, of a man going to a Zen teacher, and he goes to a Zen teacher and asks him some question, profound question about the nature of reality, and the Zen teacher calls for tea, and so somebody in the monastery brings two cups and a pot of tea, pot of probably green tea, and the Zen master starts pouring into the man's cup, and he goes on pouring, and he goes on pouring, and he fills the entire cup, but goes on pouring, and goes on pouring, until the cup is just overflowing, and spilling out onto the floor, and the man says, "Stop, stop, the cup is already full." And the Zen master says something like, "Yes, the cup is already full. Your cup is already full. So how can I teach you anything?" So what he meant by that is that there was no receptivity in that man. He'd come full of his own opinions and already fixed views as to what the nature of reality was. And in a sense, it was a game to ask the Zen master about Buddhism, because he wasn't ready to hear anything that didn't already agree with his views. His cup was full, so it could hold no more. Yeah? In a similar sense, we've got to look at, well, how receptive are we? How receptive are we? Are we willing to be taught? Are we willing to learn? Are we willing to be trained? So Dhamma means those that are capable of being trained. Maybe we can talk, when we talk in groups, a little bit more about what that sort of receptivity means. Because in Buddhism, it doesn't mean that you're uncritical. It doesn't mean that you just say, yes, I agree with anything that the teacher says, without thinking for yourself. It's not that sort of gullible receptivity. It's a much more intelligent, engaged receptivity, where you do think for yourself, but you are open to the possibility that the teacher, in this case the Buddha, has something to teach you. Yeah. So you're open to him, to whatever degree you can. So purusa means humanity. Dhamma means those that one who is capable of being trained, who is even desirous for training. And sarati means something like the one who trains, but it's more, it's got the sort of connotation of one who trains animals. So it's like a tamer, yeah? Like a lion tamer that you'll find in a circus, an animal tamer. So Bodhisattva Sarati, yes, means something like the Buddha is the one who tames those that are desirous of being trained. Do you see what I mean? Those human beings that are desirous of being tamed. He is the tamer of them, as it were. I quite like the word tamer, because it implies that we're not just rational, civilized, kind of only existing from the neck up kind of animals, beings, where we are animals. Our hearts and minds need taming. In a certain sense, we're human animals that are driven by craving. We're always wanting something. That is, from a Buddhist perspective, what it means to be unenlightened. It means to be full of craving. Now, of course, that craving can be satisfied temporarily, but it's never fully satisfied. Yeah? Buddhism's, what it's saying is that we're never fully, completely, utterly satisfied. We're a sort of embodied wanting. We're an embodied desiring. That's what it is to be embodied. And of course those wantings and those desirings can be fairly obvious, things like hunger and thirst, or a desire for more sexual craving, or they can be more subtle, like a sort of existential wanting fulfillment, an existential sort of search for satisfaction. And That's what we are. And the Buddha's teaching is saying, well, that craving, that thirst, that desire, whilst very understandable, because it's in all of us, that is the root cause of our suffering. That is the root cause of our unsatisfactoriness, because our desires can never be completely fulfilled for any kind of lasting duration. They can be temporarily sort of suspended or assuaged, but never completely fulfilled. So in a certain sense, yeah, we require taming in terms of, or training in terms of our hearts and wills, if you like. So Purusadhamma Sarati is one who restrains or tames those that are capable or wanting to be tamed or trained. Another implication of this is that the Buddha understands us. So if you had a lion tamer, the lion tamer would really have to understand the nature of the beast. Yeah? In order to avoid being eaten, he'd have to really understand how to work with the animal. Well, the Buddha understands the human animal. He understands us. He understands how to train us. He understands the way our minds work, the way our hearts work. And he knows the teachings and the techniques and the methods for training us. So he sees us. Now, of course, we're all individual, aren't we? We've got our individual different biases, temperaments, characters, and personalities. And obviously our situations are all very different. But the Buddha understands fundamentally what it is to be human. Yeah? What it is to be human. So in that sense, he understands each of us deeply and can respond appropriately. He can respond appropriately. So in this translation, what you've got is anuttaro is elided, as it were, with Buddhist Dhammasarati. So what you get then is he's the guide unsurpassed of men to be tamed. And by men here, that's just a sexist way of saying all human beings. Guide unsurpassed of humans to be tamed. So that's it's a sort of loose translation of Anuttara Buddhist Dhammasarati. So let me just pause there and see if there are any questions on just that.
Just wonder in terms of, I wonder if the lion tamer analogy could be a bit unfortunate.
In what way?
Well, I think quite often, I think of circuses and I think of exploitation.
Really. Circuses as exploitation.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's an issue where.
Oh, yeah, I see, yeah.
Yeah, it's not really calling this a task because it's just an analogy.
Yes, yes.
The thing is about an analogy like that is actually, I think, for instance,
yes.
Dogs that are around humans apparently are less intelligent than dogs that are around wine. So I think there's an issue there where I think the Buddha is, in a sense, he's trying to lead any being to his potential and to his heart.
Yes.
Rather than, it's about taming, I think that can have a connotation of being made pliable
and docile.
Not necessarily realising one's potential.
Yes, yes. No, I agree with that, actually. I agree, and that would be an unfortunate kind of connotation. The reason I like it is that it implies that we're not rational beings. It sort of implies that a large aspect of what we're trying to do when we try and practice the Dharma is get in touch with those deeper urges and emotional drives that aren't open to reason. And they feel like they're wilder, deeper, and more in need of taming than training. But taming in the sense of guiding and not suppressing, but pointing in the right direction, and so that our potential can be fulfilled. So yes, in that sense, an animal tamer is not an adequate analogy. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Could it be that there's lack of word in English, because in French, for instance, everybody's maybe familiar with the Little Prince.
Yes.
Where the acrobazine was actually to be won over slowly.
Yes.
So we don't, and there's no translation into English.
Right. Yeah.
But
indeed.
It's also taming in a.
In a positive
with
way,
love.
With love. That's right. Yeah. Well, that would be a really good way of seeing it. Then, yeah. And it might be that yes, we don't have quite I'm not a Pali scholar, so I can't say exactly what the Pali meant or what connotations it has. No, that's right. No, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, so that would be a good way of thinking about it, because Buddhism's not about oppressing us. Quite the contrary, it's about setting us free. And it's not about power, it is about working with love. At the same time, it's not shy of working with all of us. I mean, every aspect of us, do you see what I mean? And those aspects that aren't amenable to reason and are more difficult to bring into service of the Dharma. And we probably all sort of recognise that you don't have to be meditating for very long to know that we're not such nice people as we appear on, when we're walking down the street. We may appear nice and civilised, but you don't have to be meditating for very long to get to know your mind and what happens. We've just had a spring retreat on the attack of Mara, and Mara hurls at the Buddha all the weapons of hatred and anger and all the powers of lust and craving. And Mara, you could see as an embodiment of those forces within our own mind. And they're there. And fair enough, Buddhism doesn't get into guilt about it. And you don't have to feel guilty or embarrassed to be unenlightened. That's just how it is. But you do have to get to know yourself in order to work with yourself. And it helps if you can do that with other people who are also doing that. Now, we don't have the Buddha here. We don't have the Buddha in his physical presence here to help us learn to train our minds. But we do have each other. And in the Sangha, what you find is that some people have more experience than other people and can help. Some people have been meditating for longer and know what it's like to work with the mind, and that can help. And then, of course, we ourselves will meet people who we can help. And that's the point of Sangha, as it were. That's the point that we help each other. And at the same time, we have to keep referring back to the teachings of the Buddha so that we don't get into the blind leading each other astray. Do you see what I mean? We have to keep referring back to the tradition to make sure that we stay on track. Okay, let's have a cup of tea, and then we'll come back and look at the rest of this verse. Good. Okay, so let's carry on. So the next line is Satta Deva Manusanang. Satta Deva Manusanang. And Satta is... teacher. It's sort of quite straightforward. Satta is teacher. Deva is the gods. So Buddhism doesn't believe in a creator god with a capital G. But it does, in the Buddhist cosmology, there are non-human beings, non-material beings even, beings that are made of light. That are celestial beings that live in other dimensions, other realms that we can't perceive with our senses. So Buddhism does believe in fact, lots and lots of planes of existence that are sort of next to each other, parallel to each other, with non-human beings. Some of them are divine beings in the sense that they are more refined, more blissful than human beings. That doesn't mean they're enlightened. In fact, the gods are not enlightened. The gods, too, live in conditioned existence. They live in samsara. It's just said that they live in... they live very, very long lives in these heavenly, beautiful, divine realms. But... from a Buddhist perspective, that isn't always a good thing. From a Buddhist perspective, you can be reborn in one of these realms, depending on how you've acted in this life. But what tends to happen, at least for some of the gods, is that their lives are so blissful that they forget to practice the Dharma. So they live in a very, very refined, exalted way, but they don't realise that things are impermanent. And eventually, even their long lives come to an end, and they've not made any progress. In fact, their good fortune, their karma's run out, and then they have to be reborn in a lower realm. So, the Buddhist cosmology actually doesn't put gods as the highest of the beings, although there are some gods who do practice the Dharma, and there's all sorts of levels. But what I find interesting, whether you take it literally or not, those levels, is that the Buddhist universe is populated by lots and lots of different beings. For Buddhism, actually, the whole universe is somehow alive. It's not just that we've got human beings and animals that we can see that are alive. The Buddhist world is an animate universe where everything is alive. And you could say that it's more like a pagan view of the universe, a pre-Christian pagan view that we used to have in this country, in this culture, where the trees and the rivers and the mountains and even the rocks and the woods are somehow alive. Nature is alive. And Buddhism would say, yes, that's truer to how things are than our sort of postmodern view of the universe, where nothing's alive. Even us, we sometimes doubt whether we're genuinely creative beings or just biological machines. We live in this sort of rather dead universe often. We think in those terms, whereas Buddhism has quite the opposite perspective. So, Deva is gods, and Manusanang is another word for mankind. So again, here it's translated as men, but it means humankind, it means mankind. So the Buddha is the teacher of gods and humankind. And what that means is, he's the teacher of all beings. All beings, at whatever plane of existence they are at, the Buddha is their teacher. Again, it goes back to the notion that the Buddha is the highest possible being, the highest possible realized being, and he teaches all beings. So in the early suttas, you sometimes get the Buddha teaching human beings in the daytime and the gods at night. And Subhuti, when he was giving this talk, said, well, you could see that in psychological terms and see the Buddha teaching in his dreams, in his dream life. Teaching heavenly beings in his dreams. And if you do see it in psychological terms, although I don't think that it needs to be limited to that, you could see that the Buddha, even in his subconscious dream world, is still a Buddha. Yeah? Subhuti made the point that sometimes in our dream world, we're quite different beasts or animals, aren't we, or people, to how we are in our waking life. But the Buddha is fully integrated. His subconscious isn't unavailable to him. He's a Buddha all the way through his consciousness. Do you see what I mean? So you could see that this in psychological terms, if you wanted to. But yes, traditionally it would be that the Buddha is the teacher of all beings, of gods and human beings. Yeah. And in the suttas you get, sometimes you get the Buddha, you get sort of Buddhist kind of jokes where people go to some of the Hindu gods and say, what's the answer to this question about existence? And the Hindu gods will say, I don't know, but ask the Buddha, because he'll know. And so there's a sort of polemic going on between the Hindu world and the Buddhist world, if you see what I mean. And the Buddha is seen as the highest in the Buddhist world, above even the Hindu gods. So it's almost like the Buddha's in a species of his own, because he was born a human being rather than some god, but he transcended ordinary humanness, and in a certain sense, Bhante said that you could see him as a new species. It's almost like he's as different to ordinary humanity as human beings are to animals. It's like human beings have developed faculties that animals don't have, like reason, like the capacity to reason and think in language. Well, the Buddha has capacities over and above the human capacities that we have, so it's another order of being. Okay, so that's Satta Deva Manusanam. And then you end that verse with Buddho Bhagavati. So this is just saying, yes, he really is this wonderful radiant being. He really is Buddho, which means this awakened being. He really is Bhagava, which means this radiant. Or here it's translated as richly endowed. And T is like... It is closing the bracket with iti piso. Such indeed is he. And T is sort of ending that clause and saying, yes, he really is. So it's a sort of emphatic. So you've got all these qualities of the Buddha that are identified in this verse. And then what you get is you just get this... this sort of exclamation of devotion. So we're back down to us in the next line, and what you get is an expression of going for refuge to the Buddha. So you get buddhaṃ jīvata paryantaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, which is, as is there translated as, all my life I go for refuge to the awakened one. So, saraṇaṃ is translated as refuge. Gacchāmi is to go, I go. So, buddhaṃ, and jīvata is life. So, jīvata paryantaṃ means all my life. I go for refuge to the Buddha. Buddhaṃ, jīvata paryantaṃ, saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. And I know that sometimes people don't like this language of going for refuge. And refuge can have connotations in English, it's probably quite accurate connotations of seeking shelter, of somehow escaping from the world, etc. But I think it's worth trying to get a sense of what it means to go for refuge in Buddhist terms. Because what you're saying here is that's where you're putting your emotional investment, in a way. That's what you're investing in emotionally and in terms of your actions, what you're basing your life on. Because you could say that we're all the time going for refuge to something. We're all the time going for refuge to something. We're all trying to make sense of our lives. We're all trying to become happier and more fulfilled, and we're all looking for something to help us do that, something or someone. So often it's relationships or family, but it could be career, it could be status, it could be all sorts of things that we look for to make us fulfilled. And in this traditional language, you could say that's what we go for refuge to. And what we're saying here is that, no, I'm going to try and go for refuge. I am going to go for refuge all my life to the Buddha and the realization of Buddhahood. Yeah. So that's quite. So I was talking in there about revolution. It's a revolutionary act to say, I'm going to reject worldly refuges and base my life on these spiritual ideals. That's what you're saying. So all my life, I go for refuge to the awakened one. It's an expression of devotion. And then that continues. So, yecha buddha atita cha. So what that's saying is to all the Buddhas of the past. So although the Buddha is an enlightened being that's a supreme being, he's not the only one. So in the Buddhist tradition, you've got Buddhas throughout time. Throughout time and throughout space, you've got enlightened beings who are teaching the Dharma, who have discovered the Dharma and who are teaching the Dharma. So, from a mythological point of view, perspective, the Buddha that we know of as Shakyamuni Buddha, who was lived 2,500 years ago in northern India, was one of a long line of Buddhas. And later Buddhism talks about Buddhas in other parts of the universe, and even in other universes. So what this is saying is that you're not just going for refuge to one being that happened to live 2,500 years ago in Asia. You're going to for refuge to the principle of Buddhahood. You're going for refuge to the principle of enlightenment. And that enlightenment, that principle of Buddhahood, is eternal. So different beings may realize that principle, discover that principle for themselves, but the principle is there regardless of whether it's ever discovered or not, or realized or not. Do you see what I mean? It's eternal throughout time, throughout space. The potential for realizing the truth is always there. The potential for waking up to things is always there. So this is sort of saying, yes, you recognize that eternal principle. To all the Buddhas of the past, I go for refuge. And the next line is to all the awakened ones of the future. So anagata means those to come, those that have not, those that are yet to come. So you've got the past and the present, the past and the future. And then the next line is to all the Buddhas of the present. So pachupanna cheye buddha. Pachupanna is the present, to all the Buddhas that are existing now. So again, Buddhism would say that there are enlightened beings now. The Buddha, when he passed away, wasn't the last of his kind. There are many enlightened beings that he left, and the potential for enlightenment is still here now, in the present. So, yes, you've got yecha buddha atitacha, yecha buddha anagata, pachupama cheye buddha, and then ahang vandami sabada. So, ahang vandami sabada is another sort of expression of devotion. Vandami is worship, which is what we've been looking at already. Sabada means all of them, to all of them. And here it's translated that line as my worship flows unceasingly. Unceasingly. So what you've got then is an expression of commitment to the Buddha jewel. And in Buddhism, that's an active commitment. The fact that you go for refuge is really significant. It's not saying that I just believe in enlightenment. You're going towards it. That means that you're committing to realizing it for yourself in your own being. You're committing to move closer and closer until you become an awakened being. That's what going for refuge means. It's active. It's not something like you just have to believe and sign up for. It's not just an article of faith, that's what I'm trying to say. It's an active commitment, an orientation that you're trying to move your life in. And then you get this this line, nati me saranang anyang. So here it's translated as no other refuge than the wake. So in Buddhism, going for refuge to the Buddha is exclusive. It's not that you can go for refuge to the Buddha and also go for refuge to worldly success. They're mutually exclusive. Now, of course, we do go for refuge to both, but to the extent that we go for refuge to worldly values, we're not going for refuge to the Buddha to that extent. Do you see what I mean? So when we're hankering after worldly things, whatever that is, power, material things, love in the ordinary sense and family, etc., we're not going for refuge to the Buddha. So it's exclusive in that sense. Also, having said that, though, Buddhism's very sort of, it's uncompromising in that sense, but it's also very understanding. The Buddha understands, Buddhism understands, that we can't just switch off that wanting worldly things and suddenly reorientate our being towards the Buddha. It's a gradual process of transforming our hearts and minds so that more and more we come to rely upon what really gives us happiness. So it's a gradual transformation that happens. You go for refuge more and more deeply. You go for refuge more and more fully. It's not a thing that you just do once. You do it continually. And in Sangharakshita's view of Buddhism, that is the central act of a Buddhist. A Buddhist is somebody who's trying to go for refuge more and more. Yeah, more and more deeply. That's what we're all trying to do, if you think of yourself as a Buddhist. And some people are doing that more consistently or more deeply, but there's always possibility of doing it more deeply. Yeah. It's a sort of perpetual process. So nati me saranang yang is a very here. It's because this is a devotional text. It's almost an ecstatic text. It's saying no other refuge for me is there for me. Yeah, and at times we can feel like this when you're really inspired. You might think that's it. I've found it. This is the truth. And I'm not going to do anything else with my life. In my own experience, I can have moments like that, but then I come back to my life, and I still want, the Apple Mac in my case, and the nice meal, and the films, and the comfort, and the lines, and all the rest of it. So it's not that you can necessarily maintain what you're saying here, but you say it out of inspiration, trying to reaffirm the aspiration. And later on, the next verse that we'll look at is talking about what happens when you fall short of this aspiration. But we're going to look at that next week. So, nati me saranang yang. No other refuge than the wake. Now, another way of talking about this being exclusive is to say that, having said that Buddhism doesn't require you to believe in anything, that's not to say that Buddhism doesn't have views about what things are like. And you can't, being a theist, you can't, for example, believe in a creator God and also be going for refuge to the Buddha. Yeah. So sometimes people say this to me. They say, can I be a Buddhist and a Christian or a Muslim or Hindu or whatever? And, you know, I'd like to say yes, because you want to encourage people. But actually the answer is no, not really. you don't have to stop believing in order to practice meditation. You can sort of believe what you like and make use of the Buddhist path. But if you're going for refuge to the Buddha as a Buddhist, and to the Buddha as the highest being, then that implies that it's exclusive. Yeah? Because if you really recognize the Buddha as the Buddha, then you'd see him as above any god. And besides, Buddhism doesn't believe in a creator god. So in that sense, it's exclusive. And that's quite important, because you do have some Buddhist teachers who, I think, out of positive, well, definitely out of positive reasons, want to encourage and therefore say things like, yes, you can be a Christian and a Buddhist, and that's fine. And I think what they want to try and do is just encourage the spiritual aspiration in people and not force them to change culture. Do you see what I mean? But unfortunately, I think it can just lead to confusion. It's better, to bite the bullet and say, no, Buddhism has a particular set of beliefs, and if you want to practice Buddhism as a Buddhist, then this is what it means. Although you don't have to practice as a Buddhist, you can gain from Buddhist practice without becoming a Buddhist. Do you see what I mean? So in that sense, it's very open. Okay, I'm going to leave it there, and we're just going to break up into groups. So just to remind you what I've been saying that from a Buddhist perspective, the Buddha is the highest being. That he is the tamer or the trainer of humanity, provided you're willing to be trained. He's the teacher of gods and men, of all beings, that there are other beings apart from human beings in the universe. He's the teacher of gods and men. And then we've got this devotional thing about going for refuge. All my life I go for refuge to the Buddha, and then there's Buddhas of the past, Buddhas of the future, Buddhas of the present, i.e. Buddhahood as a principle. And then I've said that if you do say that, or if you do that, then you're implying not going for refuge to other things. It's exclusive in that sense. Nati me, saranang anyang, no other refuge than the wake. So that's what we've been talking about.